Most L&D podcasts tell you how things should work. We're here to talk about how they actually work. From failed learning strategies to the uncomfortable truths of digital transformation, L&D Uncovered digs into the real conversations happening across the UK right now. So, no major theory, no massive buzzwords, just practical insight from people who have been there and done it and learned the hard way. We try to keep it under 30 minutes, so no fluff, just what matters. I'm your host, Tom Payne, and this is L&D Uncovered. Welcome to L&D Uncovered. I'm Tom Pape, and today I'm joined by Carlo Jose from GSK and Laurie Niles Hoffman, all the way from Toronto, as we dive into how L&D is shifting from compliance to capability in a high-stakes industry. We explore the future of learning, the pressures shaping it, and even get a little philosophical along the way. So welcome, guys. Hello, Carlo. Hello, Laurie. How are you guys?
Really good, Tom. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Likewise, it's good to meet again.
Lovely to see you both. Today, we are, as we've already talked about, going to be talking about compliance to capability and the future of L&D in what we're calling high-stakes industries. And you both have got a really good perspective of what's happening specifically across the industry, but also more closer to home in one particular industry, Carlo, in your world, pharma. And of course, you come from finance as well, right? So you've got a good view, you might have a good view in terms of what's happening in those worlds. But the first question, if I can go to you, Carlo, is what makes L&D in pharma fundamentally different?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom. What I would say in the time I've spent in pharma, and again, my baseline is comparing it with financial services, is that if I look at the industry and the core of our business, there's quite a lot of our focus on research and development, as well as in the manufacturing and supply chain process before we get products out to the market. And so what I would say is that I don't necessarily think we're significantly different from other highly regulated industries, but the fact that we have a lot of safety protocols and compliance kind of bits that we need to look after in both the R&D process and supply chain and manufacturing, I think there's a significant volume of attention around being kind of compliant and protecting our license to operate, being audit ready when we have to face off with regulators and things like that. And all of these things are in service of ultimately the consumer and society and protecting the business. So I would say if I were to try to boil it down, the volume of things that we need to look after from a compliance and license to operate perspective is far higher than what I've seen in other organizations. But not to say that I don't think that we are uniquely in that category of high stakes. I think every industry and every business is probably going to say they're kind of in the business of high stakes decisions and safety and regulation. But I think it's just varying degrees is what my experience tells me. What about you, Laurie?
Yeah, I would agree. But I think there's also in every industry, as you were saying, could be different stakes. I had a client once that was actually a nuclear reactor, and it was nuclear energy, and the protocols there were unbelievable, rightfully so. made me actually have a lot more comfort. So I think it's really also too about, I sometimes though have mixed feelings in terms of what is actually training and what is actually just policy communication and what are we signing off on? So what is actually learning with a capital L and what is keeping us safe? Now, at the end of it, if it keeps us safe, that's fine, but there can be variations along that scale. I mean, even in finance, where I have quite a bit of background in, and you do as well, Carlo, the stakes are high, but they're not life and death. So I think there's also too that bit of a difference.
Thanks, Laurie. And just going back, Carlo, to you saying that it's probably been one of the most compliance-led industries you've worked in, and you've worked in the financial industry as well, amongst other places. Is it more so than finance in pharma?
Well, I think I have a slightly different take in that to what Laurie mentioned. I think you can find the thread of, is this going to affect life, even in financial services? And when I think back to my time in banking, it was around anti-money laundering and sanctions, which does have potential downstream impacts around terrorist funding and all sorts of bad actors that will try to leverage financial systems and the financial kind of ecosystem and banks and all that. So, we do have I'm pretty sure that, you know, even in the farm industry where we focus on vaccines and medicines, how would you compare that to a brand that makes shampoo, for example? Well, there still are some safety considerations in their testing and development process and their manufacturing process. So I think you're right. The stakes might be slightly different or a little bit less direct in that when you look at pharma, it's kind of directly consumed medicines and vaccines. You've got a fairly immediate kind of close contact to humans that will have kind of a potential safety issue when products aren't built correctly, tested properly, go through the right kind of trials and all that kind of stuff. The other thing I look at in the pharma industry that's slightly different is that we take medicines and vaccines to market that have gone through significant trials and testing and approvals from regulators to help protect consumers and protect society. But you're not off the hook after the product's gone out to market. You could potentially have adverse effects that are discovered later on down the road. And you have to navigate that as an organization in terms of your risk appetite and how you kind of, you know, ensure that your products are kind of sufficiently kind of tested and compliant with regulation. But equally, there's still some kind of downstream risks that you need to accept and be able to manage.
So I think it's fair to say that most industries, the learning impacts performance in pharmaceuticals, in finance, and certainly in the nuclear industry, it can really impact outcomes at a much deeper level. So got to keep aware of that. So usually, and it's interesting, Laurie, you talk about learning with a capital L and communications. It was always a challenge I had when I worked in the corporate industry, that communications and telecommunications businesses, often communications was pushed as learning, and they'd knock on the door and say, we need this, and it wasn't learning per se. And sometimes those two areas can merge. If we talk about compliance versus capability, as we kind of move on a little bit, one again for you, Carlo, how do we move beyond the tick box compliance? Because I guess you see a lot of that, right, in your compliance training in pharma?
Yeah, I certainly do. And I think the knee-jerk reaction or the kind of traditional practice is if you've got an SOP or kind of written standards that you need to comply by or procedures or processes that you need to follow, the standard approach is, here's the manual, go read it and confirm to us that you've read and understood it. Yeah, it's a very kind of common practice in L&D in highly regulated markets of the read and understand training, which isn't quite training. It's more information transfer and awareness rather than building actual capability. But I think that only takes you so far. And kind of the obvious next step is, well, you've been given an SOP or an instruction manual or a procedure to follow. What then happens when you're in the actual workplace executing the activity, executing the process? And what is the quality control mechanism and the kind of support that you get to make sure that you get that done correctly? Now, I think technology and innovation is helping to avoid obvious mistakes and obvious kind of deviations. And I think this is where we need to start shifting our thinking from compliance to capability in the set. And what I mean by that is capability needs to be built around your ability to judge and kind of exercise your discernment when things don't go right. So 99% of the time, if you've got a good process and the technology supports you to avoid defects and errors and deviations, there will be that 1% where you've got to figure out what to do. So I think that's where that human capability isn't kind of overcome by the simple checklist. You still need to build capability for people to be able to achieve the end outcome that goes outside of the normal parameters.
It makes complete sense. And Laurie, before I come to you, it seems to me it's that kind of angle of completion versus competence, or mandatory versus meaningful, right? Making a real impact to what we do. And I'm just going to put this question to you, Laurie, is do you think in the L&D industry, we are stuck in the products and services that we offer rather than focusing on what's competence, what's meaningful, what's the impact, rather than, oh, we do compliance. Yes, it's tick box. Yes, we get that thing done. It's off the shelf. There you go.
I would agree, but I can't blame us entirely. So normally I'm going to give us a bit of a pass in the sense that is what we're measured on. That is also too why we often exist within organizations as a start. I mean, I can remember back to when we first put in LMSs, and the idea was it was because of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, where we had to demonstrate that we had done compliance training. Anti-money laundering training was the main one across 100,000 people. So we're a product of that, and there's still a mentality, I think, when a CEO or a CFO invests, they know that that is a hygiene factor that they have to operate in a regulated environment, be it finance, be it pharma, be it in manufacturing, anywhere that you're operating. So I think there's that. You also too have the regulators themselves who will only accept learning in a certain format in order for it to be accepted under their terms. And some of these get very specific. I won't go into things like NASBA requirements, but it gets very complicated at GXP, how many questions you can ask in an hour, et cetera. So we're driven by that because we have to. These are business requirements. We should be operating in the other layers if we want to be the best for our organization. To Carlo's point, when something goes wrong, what do we do? I would also say to the idea of creating a culture that is focused on risk and the importance of that. Back to the nuclear power plant that I worked with, it was very interesting. They started every single meeting, did not matter which area of the company that you were in, every single meeting started with a safety moment. And it was, what's one thing you've noticed or one thing that you've seen, anything to do with safety. And that ran through every single meeting, even if you were in L&D and you weren't actually working in the plant, et cetera. I also think, too, just because people pass the test, we all know this, it doesn't mean that they're going to behave that way out in the wild. But I'm also going to say some of that is L&D, yes, and we want to have that competency. Sometimes, too, it's a failure of systems. And I've seen that also happen in finance. There was an issue where we had a platform that was allowing something that was called a third-party transfer. And they kept telling L&D had to keep saying, you can't do a third-party transfer. I'm like, but your system doesn't stop them. So the person will be challenged by a client saying, well, see, you can do it. And so they would be conflicted. And that's, to me, is not necessarily just a learning problem. It is, but it's also systemic. But in terms, though, back to the question about moving into competency, in an ideal world, that would be great that that's the place that we focus 90% of our time in. And I hope that we're moving more towards that. But we're still even constricted by the fact that we just produce courses or learning interventions. And I see the future going way beyond that and into AI tutors, which is completely different from where we are. I will stop now because I can see Carlos, I'm sure, has stuff to add, and we'll have a friendly challenge.
You've just kind of triggered some thinking in my mind about, when I reflect on my experiences about kind of preventing and managing financial crime risk, as an example, in financial services. You're absolutely right. There are systemic things that need to be fixed in order to help prevent or mitigate financial crime. On top of that are the individuals who are processing transactions or engaging with customers. They have to have the right knowledge and skills and capability to be able to navigate those different kind of scenarios that are potentially high risk. And you've got to have the right culture, and it has to be part of the conversation in an organization so that people aren't stuck in just kind of mentally checking off boxes and sometimes missing what's obviously in front of them. And I can think of many different examples that came to light when financial services was under scrutiny. Many banks have been through this before around managing and mitigating financial crime. It's sometimes down to the individual kind of relationship manager or teller, or it's in the individual processor making a judgment call on what's allowed and what isn't, and what's acceptable and what's not, and raising a flag that says, we need to do something about this. So I think it's a combination of those things. We can't keep looking at just L&D as in a silo, a single silver bullet that will hope to solve it, because we know from our practice that's never the case. You can do so much on learning and development, and be kind of the impacts of that can be nullified by all of the things that are outside potentially of your control. So you've really got to look at these from a holistic perspective. What is a business outcome that we're trying to achieve? What is the risk that we're trying to mitigate? And then get down to the nitty-gritty of, well, what are the different components and kind of environmental factors that affect that? It's not just individuals, taking some training and hoping for the best afterwards.
So, and thanks both. I agree with that. I'm going to ask a cheeky question. I'm going to pop one in here, right? You talked about L&D being seen as part of an integrated part of the business, key part of the business to be able to deliver the strategy, to deliver what the business needs to deliver. Yes, no, and why? Do you think the majority of large organizations see L&D as an integrated part of the business or not?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, they're going to give lip service to it. But for me, the evidence is if you're not going to give people the time to learn, because that's always a push. And if you're not going to invest in things better than what we currently have, That to me is where that's demonstrated. There are outliers. I'm going to absolutely say that. There are, and there are companies who do it really well. But in general, if you sat down with a CEO and a CFO in times of crunch, where are the places that they're going to shape from first?
I'd have to second that. I mean, what I would say as well is that I don't think that L&D and even HR broadly is 100% kind of owning and earning a seat at the table. I think it varies over time. And even within the same organization, you know, HR gains credibility and gains a seat, and then sometimes it loses credibility and loses the seat. And so I think, you know, I spent 2 decades in financial services, and I could see that, you know, there was an era where HR was second fiddle. And then there was an era where HR and L&D were seen as quite important partners and enablers for the business. So I think it's all a factor of kind of leadership and priority and credibility of your HR teams and L&D teams to kind of show value and demonstrate that they are there to partner and support and enable the business. I think for me, the very idealistic picture that we all aspire for is that we are, in fact, just as important as the CFO, as the COO in the C-suite. But, you know, the other interesting thing I'm seeing right now is that not every organization has a chief learning officer or a C-suite person that represents learning or capability or talent. You always have that person, more often than not, within the HR function, sitting underneath a chief people officer or a chief HR officer. It's neither right or wrong, but I think it's also a reflection of how important is the kind of the learning function as an enabler for the business.
I would agree, and I say something that may be offensive to some, but in many organizations that I've worked with, the CLO, to your point, in terms of hierarchy, they're usually sitting at a VP level, right? So they're not actually at the C-suite. Secondly, it's usually a tour of duty, meaning it's not somebody who comes from L&D who really knows it. It's usually somebody very, very senior with a passion for learning. And a lot of companies make that mistake. And a passion for learning, I say this all the time, I don't want a brain surgeon with a passion for brain surgery. I want somebody who knows it and understands how this works. But that more often than not is something that I see. It's almost a political role rather than somebody really driving the learning agenda.
Really interesting. And again, I don't disagree with any of that from my experience in the corporate world. And again, I was in the corporate world for 20 odd years, and it was exactly what Carlo said. Sometimes we had more influence, sometimes we didn't. It was very much dependent on the talent in those seats at that time. It was also whether the C-suite had an appetite for it or not, or saw value in it or not. And I guess the thing I would just kind of conclude is it's shared challenge, right? It's the L&D industry and people that work in that industry to prove their worth and to move away from what we would call just tick box exercises to get more into the impact and the benefit and the return of investment and to be a voice at that table. But also, it's going to be a challenge in any organization if they don't take it seriously, because you could have those talented people and they still could be ignored, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. What I would also say is, you know, learning functions in organizations operate differently. Sometimes they're federated, sometimes they're held at the center and much more kind of standardized in their practices, and they're much more connected across an organization. And again, this isn't a one's better than the other kind of topic. I think, you know, for listeners out there who might be thinking about, well, what does this mean for the L&D practice and the L&D community? You got to be ready to participate in the conversation when the opportunity presents itself. And it's that whole kind of adage of 99% preparation and 1% luck and opportunity, right? When you get that moment where L&D and HR have the ability to have that seat at the table and provide input, you've got to be ready. Now, all the other times where you don't feel like you do, it shouldn't stop you from trying to create an impact and work with your businesses. And that's kind of your preparation time to really get deep into understanding your organization. Same is true for me. I'm kind of 2 years into the pharma industry. I clearly am not a pharma industry veteran, and I've got a lot to learn about how this business works. But every day that I spend here engaging with our business customers and our employees helps me to understand better what's going on in the organization, but also in the industry as a whole. And that just helps to build my preparation levels for if I were to engage in a conversation a year from now, I'll be much more prepared than I am today, because I'm actively acquiring that knowledge and insight from our employees and from our business partners and kind of just listening to what's happening in the industry and across the organization.
But I'm going to say, Carlo, and that's amazing that you're doing that. A lot of times, though, in L&D, I feel like there's a lot of navel gazing and they're not looking at the business. And that, for me, can be frustrating. Even when I see, you know, okay, I say, do you have, what's your learning strategy for the year? It doesn't tie into the business at all. And I'll ask them, okay, what are the KPIs for your business? How does your business make money, save money, or mitigate risk? It's going to fall into those three buckets. And they'll say, well, you know, we manufacture, you know, X, or we do this. Okay, but there's going to have been some sort of metrics put against that, and there's going to be initiatives, and there's going to be this and that, and they will struggle with that. And I think that's something that we all need to be tapped into. You have to really understand how the sausage gets made or the tofu gets made at whatever company you're in.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, as cliche as it might sound, you know, companies have purpose, mission statements, vision statements. And some people might say, oh, that's all nice and good for the corporate website and the brochure. But I actually look at that as the articulation of what is this organization's purpose. And people, especially in the support functions like L&D or in HR, sometimes have a difficulty making that connection. But you know, when I look at pharma as an example, so we have a mission and a purpose that is to affect the positive health outcomes for 2.5 billion people. And so my job in HR then is to become a supporter and enabler of our business to be able to achieve that. And the way I do it isn't making the vaccines and medicines. It's not selling it to healthcare providers. It's enabling our employees to have the right skills and capability and helping shape the capability organization to be ready for the future. So for me, it's a kind of well-practiced kind of line of thinking to be able to connect what I do in HR and L&D to what the company's purpose is. And you've always got to keep that in mind. It's not churning out training and counting the hours. It's enabling the organization to build capability.
Thanks both. So now we're going to slightly change a slightly more broader question to talk about what's actually changing in L&D in your worlds. So in L&D right now, I'll go to you first, Carlo. Are you seeing any kind of major changes happening inside the pharma industry?
I think in pharma, but also more broadly from an L&D practice perspective, there are some things that remain unchanged, such as our focus on supporting leaders as the multiplier effect that they have in the organization. I think the big change in my conversations over the past 12 months is going to be around our ability to adapt to the changing world of work and our ability to start leveraging new technology and innovation, which is the unavoidably artificial intelligence and generative AI tools. And that's in different parts of our workflow, whether it's manufacturing and producing learning assets, curating content, but even just delivering AI-enabled coaching capability so that all of our employees have greater access to that kind of support, which used to be much more exclusive, much more expensive, and only available to the few. So I would say that this year, my team and I are spending a lot of our time and effort understanding how we can bring this to scale across the rest of our organization. And I think it's going to deliver a significant benefit. You know, unavoidably, the consumer experience of our employees living outside in the world, outside of the 40 or 50 hours a week they spend with us, is shaping their expectations of what's happening within the organization. And we can't stand still. We need to keep up. And that's very true for the learning space, as it is for all the other kind of employee experiences, all the tools that we have available to us in the workplace.
And what about you, Laurie? What are you seeing in more generally?
I would agree with that. And I would also say the rise just of the AI tutor, of having a virtual tutor. So whether you're interacting with via Copilot or a Gemini, or it's, LearnLM, but the idea that you're learning not just through a course, a one size fits all, but that it's contextual, it's personalized to you. It's allowing also to the other big trend that I love is that it's allowing for experimentation. It used to be very difficult for us to build, you know, even a branching exercise in, you know, one of the authoring tools. Well, now you can actually build a rubric quite quickly that's personalized to somebody. In fact, you may not even have to build it, just say these are the parameters, and then it will personalize it based on what it knows about that person. And they can have a conversation, practice a sales conversation, practice a difficult coaching moment, and or explain what a product does to a colleague. You can practice that in these environments. And that, I think, opens up, there's a whole new world that we always said, you know, 70, 20, 10, you can argue about the amounts, but we did not do that very well. We did the 10% very well. And that I'm finding very fascinating. We can build simulations quite quickly. And the barrier to entry is not that expensive. I mean, I remember trying to build simulations for some of our software. And I mean, you were looking at definitely a north end of six figures price to do something like that. Now that's within reach, and at much probably 90% less. So that I think is an area that's very, very interesting to me.
Yeah, and I would say as well, when it comes to AI and these new capabilities, I think we're like at the peak of the hype cycle, probably coming down on the other side of it. So the expectations, I think, are starting to get a bit more realistic. The understanding and awareness of what is possible is becoming a bit more realistic. I think if you asked me 12 months ago, a lot of people would have said, yeah, just throw it into the LLM, it'll be fine. But there is a little bit more to it than that. But I am very excited about this new capability. And I was at a conference not too long ago with one of our partners in the LXP software space. And we had a bit of a kind of future focused session, just talking about what's the art of the possible in the future. And one of the ideas that conversation inspired in me is how can we then start to deliver kind of LXP on demand or learning experiences on demand with zero or low code, you know, kind of self-service. I think this idea of personalization taken to the nth degree is we're not going to be creating portals or platforms. It might just be a little bit like our ChatGPT experience of today, which is you're just chatting with an assistant that is building stuff for you behind the scenes, and then it becomes disposable software. It's good for you for the next 3 months. And then when your needs change, you can throw it away. And I don't know what it's going to look like, but that's the idea that inspired for me, which is this idea of ultimate personalization is you've got to give and take with the machine and allow people, educate people on how to use it so that they can get what they need. Then our job becomes managing the kind of guardrails and parameters and the underlying stack of data and technology underneath it.
It's interesting you said about AI and looking back and where you were then versus where you are now, because again, I'm seeing this, and Laurie, I think you are as well, is that there are lots of exciting opportunities with AI. So many things seem to pop up week by week in terms of things you can do with it and how it can help you in your role, certainly in the L&D world. But also what it does is you start to see its limitations. And I think that's what we're seeing right now, that we're catching up with it, and you know, it's getting better and it will get better. But it's only as good as the good in, good out method. And I've used the family friendly method rather than the non-family friendly method. But that's what we're seeing. So there's a lot of noise around AI, but I do think people are starting to get to grips with it. I think you made the point about in the outside world, people are using Gemini and ChatGPT or Claude or whatever they're using now. It's becoming part of they're not going to Google search. They're going there, right? And it's helping them, you know, maintain and admin their lives. But you mentioned, I think, low and no code personalized learning, Carla. We talked about AI-driven learning journeys, building own LXP layers and so on, or even the idea of courseless L&D and the idea that we've got more throwaway stuff, right? Because we can create this stuff so much quicker than we used to be able to. So again, I'm going to go to Carlo first with the first question. How far do you think pharma can realistically go with AI, given the regulation you work under? And can it go a lot further?
I think it can. And I kind of, one of my own reflections has been that in the past, maybe 12 to 18 months, AI became the headline as the thing that we're doing, not as the new capability that enables the thing that we're doing. So I don't think the thing that we're doing has changed. It's just that we have new capability through AI tools and AI capability and new innovation to be able to do it better and to be able to shift some of the kind of repeatable, programmable activities and tasks into a machine and shift the focus of humans into something else. So I think it's not exclusively pharma, but if I put in the layer of kind of license to operate, compliance, the read and understand training, there's certainly lots of kind of use cases for artificial intelligence tools to be able to help us to become quicker and more effective in achieving outcomes. And I'm not going to limit it to producing the asset or the content or unpacking the SCORM file in the L&D parlance. I think it's you've got to take a step back and think about AI as not the thing that you're doing, but an enabler to the thing that you're doing.
Yeah, no, I agree. Laurie, are we, and I think we've talked, I've heard you say this before, so I think I might know the answer, but I'm going to ask you again anyway, but are we heading towards a world where L&D just isn't about courses at all anymore?
Absolutely. That is the ultimate direction. I think that's a very good move. I think the one size fits all just doesn't work. When I'm challenged by this, by L&D professionals who are like, but we know pedagogy, we know this, we know that, we know how we have all of our theories. My response to that is yes, but if you were a facilitator or a teacher in a classroom and you had 20 people in front of you, you can't tell me you deliver exactly the same way every single time you walk into that classroom. You're not a robot. You would tailor it to the people in the room. You might look and say, oh, that person actually, they're coming from a different department than the others. So I'm going to make sure that I use some of their examples. That person might have English as a second language. That person just looks really tired. Like anything, you do that customization. And now we have some of those capabilities. We can do that within via tutor or via a virtual coach. I think, though, we also have to put a lens on it, though, that we are using a lot of people's data and we're going to run up against that. And I think that that's coming, where employees are going to need to understand how much data is actually being collected about them and how much is actually how it's being utilized. It probably appears in some pamphlet that they signed when they joined 17 years ago or whatever, but that's going to come to surface. But I do not see an L&D department in general that just produces courses and or procures courses, course libraries. I don't see that as happening. And even if you look at what's happening in out in the wild, Get Abstract announced they have a partnership with Copilot, so you can bring their information into Copilot and interact with it just as you would do anything else in Copilot. Very similarly, ChatGPT had theirs partnership with Coursera, and then Coursera, of course, is in the acquisition. I think they put a ring on. And I don't know if they're actually done the nuptials with Udemy. You start to see those courses, that idea of courses as a construct is changing even out in the wild.
Really interesting stuff. I think the headlines for me, it feels that learning is becoming more disposable, more contextual, less about those fixed programs. So yeah, there's a bit of change going on, right? You'll be happy to know that we're coming to the last question. We always have a lot of fun, and we seem to get through so much in such a short period of time. But it wouldn't be me if I don't ask again another cheeky question. So I'm going to ask it anyway. And this one is going to be, the next 3 to 5 years, one thing that looks really good, one thing that worries you. So what's really good that's going to happen? We've just talked about elements of it, right? And AI is probably going to be in there. But also on the flip side, what worries you? So who'd like to go first? Laurie, you've been taking second fiddle most of this. So can I go with you first, if that's okay?
Because it's so hard for me to imagine 3 to 5 years. I think that's what's freaking me out, is that sort of timeline on that. Because I don't think we know, or we can really, really understand what are going to be some of the capabilities. Just my little imagination doesn't seem to allow for that. So maybe I'll start with the one thing that, to think about is, and I have touched on it earlier, was how much these tools are ingesting of our personalities and what they can infer about us, and whether that inference that they use to generate subsequent content, whether that's even ethical or right, or how much do I want to disclose to a company, and what we're actually doing with that data. So, for example, I'm seeing a lot of tools right now that are coming up to, say, support neurodiversity. And they said, we can detect who has, autism or who has ADHD within your company. And I'm like, that terrifies me completely, because there's so many negative, I think, implications of that. And how much does a company really get to know about you? So I think that's one concern. But I think in terms of the possibilities, they're infinite. So I'll probably say what I said before. I think that idea of having a personalized tutor that understands you, I desperately love that. And I use it out in the wild. And I find that that's just so fascinating what it can do for you. So probably not the best answer, because I just don't have that creativity right now. I'm just overwhelmed.
Oh, well, thanks, Laurie. And I think you're sure honest as well. Yeah, it's difficult to look that far in the future, but I think some really good points there anyway. Carlo?
This is a really tough question for the same reasons, but I am excited about, and this is not specific to the L&D practice necessarily, I am excited about what organizations could look like in 3 to 5 years. I think there's never been a time where not just AI, but innovation and other macroeconomic factors are driving a change in the way things work and the way work is organized and companies are built. We've got the rise of the kind of single employee businesses that are kind of staffed and enabled by AI tools. So that's something that's very new and very different. You've got the kind of, this isn't new, but the kind of continuing growth of the attention economy and content creation that's happening in, you know, if we're not paying attention, like I'm not on TikTok, so I'm probably missing out on a lot of this stuff, but it's happening and it's changing the kind of composition of work and economies and business as a whole and, you know, kind of destroying borders and delineation of borders and things like that. So just as an appetite for uncertainty, as an observer of how the world works and how that might impact businesses, I think in the next 3 to 5 years, we will see significant change more than any 10 to 20 year stretch historically. You know, and we are definitely at that pivotal point where technology and innovation is really helping to make that kind of change happen. What worries me is kind of coming from the same place, which is we have this massive kind of macro trends and globalization versus kind of nationalism and things like that, that are also affecting culture and society, but also how businesses work and how people within organizations need to work. But I did get reminded of one of our, maybe someone you know from your networks as well, but if you know Mark Zhao Sanders from our friends at Filtered and other things, he was doing some kind of research on how people are using AI. And I found it really fascinating that one of the big use cases is that people are now using AI as a friend or a therapist or kind of a thought partner more than ever before. And I think that that is affecting our ability as humans to interact with each other. I think we already saw the erosion of human connection with content and content creation and attention economy. Now we've got this unlimited potential for people to get sucked into AI generated conversations and relationships. So I think for me that, you know, if I were to kind of be a bit philosophical for a moment, is a thing that is concerning to me for the future. This is kind of the Wild West of how people interact with these AI bots and chat experiences and what that might mean in terms of what does that do to society and how we connect with each other as people.
It's interesting you should say that because obviously there's a lot of news at the moment about how social media and screens are affecting children, right? And children under 16, and Australia have put in a law to ban social media, and other governments around the world are looking at it, even in the UK, they're talking about it, but haven't gone the full hog yet. And yet I agree with you, Carlo. I think there is something there about how cognitively this is affecting human beings, right? Now, I'm just going to ask one more question. It'd be interesting if you, and then we'll call it a day. In our first or second episode, when we talked about AI specifically, I asked a question and I said, just from memory, maybe we're not absolutely word perfect, is AI making people lazy? And I think it is. Because I think what it's doing is it's allowing people to just lean on it, right? It's like when you start your career and you have somebody you look up to who's a bit of a mentor or somebody that you kind of trust in what they're doing and you're getting used to the environment, you're going to hide behind those people, right? And I think people are hiding behind AI a little bit. And I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
I'm going to be probably the dissenting voice and say, if you're using it properly, no. And I think it's actually, it's a bit reductive to say like that people using AI well, like if they're using it well, yes, there's ways that you can hide behind it if you're just doing generative AI and things like that, absolutely. But I would argue that it's actually a different way of thinking, and it's more expansive and it's far more creative when you're moving beyond just, you know, producing a report or doing something basic like that. Those are the, you know, the showy moments. Those are the ones that you can say, oh, look at this. The stuff that's maybe not less sexy is rethinking an entire workflow and how that can be done with agents and an orchestration layer and using your brain to think through those things. I don't need to know how to code to do that necessarily, right? So I think it comes down to the question of, and I've asked this several times of in different scenarios, but we used to learn languages and we still learn languages. Does it really make sense to spend 10 years learning that language if I can just have auto translate happen? Now, people are going to argue there's culture and there's this and there's that. But I also, when I invest so much time learning one language, it limits me at the age of 14 when I make that decision as to where I'm going to work in my lifetime, right? So am I lazy if I don't learn a language, or is the auto prompt now freeing me up to learn other things and be able to do other things? And do I need to do those things? I think that, so maybe the definition of lazy is it just maybe placing value on tasks that we used to value more highly that we aren't going to do in the future?
Every coin has two sides. I get it. And it's not all negative. And I am being slightly cheeky with my questioning, but, and I don't disagree with you, Laurie, but I think the point is it comes into the human control and how you use stuff, right? And it can have both sides. But Carlo, thoughts from you before we sign off?
I definitely think it's driven a lot by, well, what do you bring to the table as the kind of human operator interacting with technologies, right? So it certainly has the potential for people to become lazy if they use it in a certain way, or it could be amplifying someone's capabilities to be creative and to be productive if used in a different way. I think the interesting, and I'm going to be a bit philosophical about this for fans of like Star Trek or people who go to Burning Man, where, you know, people trade goods rather than money for services and products and things like that, or in the Star Trek world where people don't get paid anymore, their needs are met. Is there a future of abundance where we are able to do the things that we would rather do rather than work, and that work becomes synonymous with what we're passionate about, whether it's exploration in space or scientific learning or music and arts and things like that? Is there a world where the kind of the grunt work of coding or the grunt work of data analysis is left to the machine? I think my big worry is, going back to the point earlier about how it impacts our ability to interact and connect with each other, we already know that these LLMs are so good at telling you they're right, even when they're factually wrong. And if people don't, you know, do the sense check and do the critical thinking to say, I'm not quite sure that's right, we will lose all kind of sense of reality and fact. And people will just rely on whatever the machine told them was the thing that was the truth.
To that point, though, maybe it's also highlighting things about our society that we need to fix that aren't going to be solvable by AI. So like you, I was really fascinated with Mark Zassander's research into how people were using AI. And my reflection on that is, it says more about us, the fact that people can't get access to affordable therapy, that they're not in a position where society allows them to be vulnerable, to speak about emotions to a person. Or they've maybe grown up in a culture that makes it unacceptable to talk about mental health, or an environment where it makes it difficult to do that. So to me, it wasn't that I was upset that they were using it for that purpose, but what does it say more broadly about who we are? And I think that reimagining of society, to your point, Carlo, is where this is going to lead us. Or I hope it does. I hope it does.
And if we go even deeper into this like conversation and line of thought, it's we've got to realize that we in this conversation are quite lucky. We are at the forefront and have the opportunity to engage with these new capabilities and technology, and we work in the spaces that we work. But the disparity between what we do versus the rest of society, there's still the haves and the have-nots, and there's still a huge inequality across the kind of the spectrum. Those are real human problems to solve for. And if we've got, you know, not to get too political, but we've got this war going on in the Middle East that just broke out at the time of this recording. This was a couple of weeks in. And we still have the one that's unresolved in Europe, in Ukraine.
And the way also too that AI has influenced that. And I mean, I was just in Poland about 50 kilometers from the border. You'd be interested to see the social media feeds and news. It's completely, this is like entering another universe.
It's different from what we normally interact with, definitely.
The world is definitely changing. Okay, thank you both. I just want to say, as always, thank you for joining over there live in Toronto. Laurie, thank you so much for joining. I'm glad we moved the timings of the recording. Otherwise, it would have been 4 a.m. So
yes.
I'm really glad we did that. So thank you, Laurie. Lovely to see you. And Carlo, live in London. I believe you're in London.
I hope that was good. We ended up in a very different place from where we started, guys.
We did. We've definitely gone from A to Z on all topics. So thanks both. Thanks for joining. We'll see you again soon. Take care. Thanks for listening to L&D Uncovered, and again, thanks to my illustrious guests. If this episode got you thinking, please do share it with someone who's shaping the future of their learning. And of course, you can follow Jampan for more conversations on the future of L&D too. So until next time, take care.